Your debut novel, Hold It Till It Hurts, centers around two African-American young men who return from a tour of duty in Afghanistan, and they learn their adopted white father has died. And within 2 days, brother Troy mysteriously leaves town, sending the central character, Achilles, on a journey to New Orleans and I think Atlanta to find him. But along the way, Achilles grapples with issues of race, which he had thought growing up he was kind of immune to. What made you choose racial identity out of race adoption, family and war trauma as your themes for your very first novel? Is there a personal connection to your life, or is it at all autobiographical?
The book is not autobiographical. I was not adopted, and I don't know that at any point I had the luxury, at least not the way I was raised, in believing that race did not affect me. But in constructing the novel, it was inspired, I think, by things that I had read, people that I knew, friends of mine, and it felt that, and this is almost this goes back to, I think, my first graduate workshop at ASU, where someone had said, the instructor had said, all good stories are about two things, at least two things. And so when I started working on this novel, it needed to be about more, I felt, than just the war, or more than just race.
Achilles is drawn as, in my view, is drawn as a complex, almost kind of delusional character on the issues of race. He seems to think he's not experienced racism in his youth, somehow convincing himself that he's been accepted, yet it's clear he's not totally accepted. There's a point in the book at which you say, especially once his friends met his adoptive white parents, there is also kind of a sense of self-loathing. You know, Achilles often uses negative language, or the language that's used in the book is often negative when describing himself and others who are black, and more flattering terms when describing white people, including the woman Inez with whom he has a romantic relationship. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was it intentional? And what are you saying through that?
Right. That is indeed very intentional. It's hard, I think, to write about race in this era, especially now that there's an illusion of post-racialness sweeping over the country. And one of my concerns now, and has long been, not only how race is negotiated between people of different cultures, but what racism over generations eventually does to a culture, how injustice can erode confidence and cohesion. And in writing about these topics today, it seemed to me that a very valuable vantage point would be one like Achilles that allows us to consider what it does to a person who's not aware of it. So Achilles suffers from extreme race shame. He has no idea that he does. And that's the irony of it, in a way. And actually a lot of readers, I don't know that all readers necessarily pick up on just how extremely distorted his self-perception is, because that's only one of the many threads. He's dealing with the PTSD and, the loss of his brother and all these questions of masculinity. But in terms of race, simply because of the particular nature of skin tone and the color line, there's still this pressing question of what it means for black people to regard other black people with the white gaze, right, and through white eyes, and to look at themselves like that. And so that's part of what's going on in the book.
My reading of your book is that Achilles' white adoptive parents were very well-intentioned and, for the most part, kind to him and his brother. However, they raised them, it seems to be kind of colorblind. And on page 290 in your book, the mother says, "Your skin color doesn't matter, and never let anyone tell you otherwise. You could just as well be purple. In fact, here we are, all purple from now on. purple people eaters. But Achilles finds out that the world judges him as a black man, and not always positively. One can infer from the book, then, that parents who raise children without an awareness of their race does them a disservice. Is that the larger message here?
That has been the experience of friends of mine who were raised like that. And so this is the challenge there, that the parents are completely well-intentioned, and they want to protect Achilles and Troy, but the difficulty is that they can't really, from their position, predict how the world is going to receive them. And, you know, it's hard, but in some ways I think this is how race has become somewhat of a tragedy for America. And in this case, it's almost like when you have a kid, when do you tell your kid Santa Claus doesn't exist? Like, at what point is it time to initiate them into the larger horrors of reality? And so that's one of the questions that the book raises. It doesn't suggest that we should not have interracial adoption, but it does take a very, hopefully clear look, or provide sort of a clear look at the difficulties involved in doing so, even when everyone has the best intentions.
What do you hope people will get out of the book? Are you just seeking to entertain? Are you seeking to make a statement? What do you hope readers will leave with?
You know, just entertainment. It's just a beach read. You don't look like you believe that. No, I, in this book, want to look at these issues and look at how they affect one person. I can't tell the reader exactly what to walk away with, but my hope is that by filtering all of this, everything from race to the war, to the questions of adoption and masculinity and friendship, through a single human being at this young age, and watching how it affects his psyche, that maybe people will develop perhaps a broader understanding of some of the complexities. And maybe it's always a long shot, but maybe empathy. That's a lot of what we hope to achieve in literature.
Can you tell me about the kinds of themes that you tend to write about? What are you most passionate about in your writing? And tell me also about your style of writing.
My style varies. I'll answer that first. My style varies. I began writing mostly experimental a style work. For this particular novel, the mode is realistic, maybe almost hyper-realistic, but that was appropriate, I felt, for this story. The novel that I'm working on now, or that's actually going out now, is somewhat slightly more satirical at times. But for this particular subject matter, the book had to be eidetic. You had to allow the reader to see and experience what Achilles is feeling at the same time he is, in order to walk away with the emotional experience that I wanted the book to be. And so that's why the style is as it is for this book. But in terms of my concerns, I have an abiding concern about social justice and how that plays out with for racial inequity, gender inequity, class inequity, you know, poverty issues. And these are questions that always manifest themselves, or that I find myself wrestling with in my work, that question of how to move to a better place. But I always feel that I can't really talk about how to move to a better place unless at the same time I'm being rather clear about where we are now. So it's avoiding this denial. We have a tendency to maybe want to deny or to look away. And I don't think that the dreaming, at least for me as an artist, is helpful if it's not counterbalanced with some very real acknowledgement of the difficulties that we're facing right now.
You grew up in New Orleans. Does that inform your views, your thoughts about racial issues, and your desire to want to focus your writing on social issues?
Very much so, because I didn't grow up only in New Orleans. So I was at Warren Easton for the last few years of high school. Sandra Bullock has since adopted it. But before that, I was in Columbia, Maryland for a few years, going to a very different public school system. So you have these two public school systems that are so markedly different as to suggest that one's almost criminal in terms of how underprepared you would be if you went through only the inner city New Orleans school system at the time that I did. And I think that having these two experiences, suburban Maryland and then urban New Orleans, have just made it impossible for me to not always be painfully aware of how much your environment plays into the possibilities for success in this country, and how important education is, you know. And it just is, it's, you know, to, if you, you would have to go from one to the other yourself, but to witness it it's actually really unsettling and upsetting, because the difference is unconscionable.
How about you, as an individual, how has race played out in your life? You talked about suburban Maryland and urban New Orleans. As African-American male, I don't want to presume, as African-American male, were your experiences positive ones? Did you notice different ones between suburban Maryland and urban New Orleans?
Well, definitely. You know, I think that Columbia, you know, at the time, because Columbia was a model city designed by the Rouse Corporation, and Columbia at the time had very little crime. It wasn't a dangerous place, and so when you're living there, you're not necessarily feeling the pressures of the larger world. You might be, maybe you'll be followed through the grocery store or something, but you don't feel as though, at least I didn't, as though race was necessarily hampering me. And I don't know that I felt it even in New Orleans, right? But what probably most curious is that it was later in life, maybe when I reached my 20s, that I look back at the different experiences and the different outcomes for the people I had known in these two places and started putting it together. I don't know that when you're 15 years old, you can really process all of it. You're aware on some level of when things aren't right, but I don't know that I, at that time, could have provided any sort of like coherent account of the differences. But later I was at a job interview, or a fellowship interview rather, in New York, and the principal of the school had asked me if I thought that a kid from inner city New Orleans could go to Stanford, because I had just finished my Stegner fellowship there. And I told him that the chances were very, very slim. You know, I said it could happen, but probably will not. You know, the kids you teach at Stanford are rather much more academically advanced than the kids coming from most public schools. And he says to me, well, you know, but you did it. And I realized, okay, he's reading this like up by the bootstrap sort of, you know, Horatio Alger kind of story in my CV. And that was a defining moment, because I kept thinking about how he was reading that story and about how unlikely it would have been. I started thinking about my classes, what I was learning, you know, the fact that they didn't even have a math class for me in New Orleans after like 10th grade. I had to go over to Xavier to take calculus. I, there were no more classes for me to take even the last half year of my senior year. I had to do an internship outside of the school, you know, and all of this really crystallized in the wake of that interview. And it also then made me think again, and this isn't directly related to the book, but how easy it is to make a good presentation that's not actually the best presentation.
Interesting. Now that you mention all of this in your background, tell me, what was your road to becoming a writer? And how did you know you wanted to be a writer? And what was that road that you took?
No, that's hard. I was always creative. I always enjoyed writing. My father, he didn't think it was the best choice. He wanted me to do something that would guarantee more financial security, which makes absolute sense in retrospect. At the time, you're 17. I'm thinking, well, why do I need to worry about a career? But, you know, he was right. He said, you know, how will you make a living? Because actually you don't, you know, you teach and learn to do other things. But at some point, I don't know. I suppose that at some point I knew that it was what I wanted to do, whether I could make a living at it or not. So I just decided it would be the sort of side vocation, right? It would just be maybe a hobby. And it gradually became mainstream. And I was fortunate to spend time at Stanford as a Stegner Fellow, and also at the University of Iowa, at the Writers' Workshop, a little time at ASU, and even here, you know, spending time with writers. This is all edifying.
And ASU is?
Arizona State University. Mm-hmm. And this all feeds the spirit. But you have to make a personal decision and a personal commitment. At least I did, because it's not as though being in those environments means that you'll find your own values reflected. And so I used those opportunities to learn as much as I could about the craft. And then I also had to come to a sort of go through a reckoning and come to a sense of peace about what I like to write about, because it's not, you know, because it's not really the most popular topic, really. You know, there's always the danger of being didactic when people have political concerns. And most fiction that we're exposed to isn't really that that socially engaged. So I sort of felt like I was putting myself at a disadvantage there. And I just decided that was okay. So I had to just come to some place where I was at peace with what I was going to do, whether or not anyone would receive it positively.
I guess here I should note that you are a visiting creative writer instructor this fall at Western Michigan University. So that puts you in a position to speak to others that are interested in being writers. What advice then, you spoke of your path, but what advice do you give to aspiring writers of all ages?
Technique, learn the craft. That's really what I focus on. I do try to avoid, in so much as possible, bringing my politics into the classroom and focus more so on the particular skills that one needs in order to be an effective writer.
And what are those?
You know, it's characterization. It's a sensitivity to language. It's effectively rendering images. So it's almost like when you learn to paint, or if you learn to play music or sing, you learn notes. So you might learn first to do shadows and still lifes, just learning the basic techniques that you can then make your own as you start to create original compositions. And so it's the same thing in writing. They're basic techniques that people learn, and that the more they master, the more efficiently they can express themselves and create satisfying stories.
Speaking of expressing yourself, you have a new book that you're working on. Can you tell me a little bit about what is that book going to be about, and when will it be released?
That book is out, making the rounds, or will be.
Oh, so it's already written.
Yes, yes. And it is, it's a short novel, and basically you have a few friends coming from California who go to Georgia to a Civil War reenactment and decide that they want to stage a what they call a protest lynching, but they're not very good with knots, and so things don't go too well for them.
Now, the central characters, what are their race that is doing this protest lynching?
You have a Caucasian female who considers herself Native American, a black male, and an Asian who refers to himself as the next Lenny Bruce Lee, who everyone thinks is Chinese, though he's actually Malaysian.
On a Sunday, February 10th, I believe it is, or is it actually February 9th?
That's been moved to Saturday the 9th.
Okay. Saturday, February the 9th at Portage District Library, you will be featured at an event put on by the Southwest Michigan Black Heritage Society. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you will be doing there and what people can see?
Well, so we'll have a reading and an author panel, and this is going to be a fantastic event because I'll be joined by, or I feel like I should say I'm joining, even though I'm the one reading, Jamie Gordon, the National Book Award winner, who will be interviewing me. She's an amazingly insightful reader. She'll have great questions, and we'll also be taking questions from the audience as well. So it will be more of a conversation. Generally, when I do appearances, I like to treat them more as dialogues than reading. So I'll read a little bit, but I think that the value in being in the room with people is to be able to actually talk to them.
Will you be signing books?
Of course, yes, and I will be signing books.
Very good. I guess we will close about this point, but I do want to say, hold it to it hurts. I'm just curious how you chose that title and what type of reader should purchase that book, because I guess I should say that it is very raw, very graphic, you know, with some like sexual content and things like that. So, you know, probably this is not for the kiddies. But why that title, Hold It Till It Hurts?
This novel actually comes from a novella collection. Mm-hmm. And so there are seven stories that include the story of Achilles, who's in here, the story of his brother, Troy, the story of his friend Wexler, and a few others. And the theme was that they were all holding it till it hurts. There was something in a way that they couldn't let go, even though it was killing them. It's like they were trying to swim against the tide holding their favorite garden statue. You know, they just won't let it go. And in the end, this is the part that became a novel. And so I just took the title for this part. It seemed to fit this all the way through because of all of the questions that it raises about not just race, which actually a lot of people don't read too much of the race line in there, because there's also the post-traumatic stress disorder. There's also the question of what it means to be a man, and what does it mean to be brave on the battlefield? Can you ever feel as though you were brave enough? What does it mean? You know, what does this fraternal fidelity mean? How, you know, to be loyal to your brothers? Like, what does that mean to be loyal to your parents? You know, how do people who are not of the same race negotiate their relationships when they feel these external pressures? But it has all these other questions, and it all sort of best encapsulated with, I guess, this simple title.
My final question, the name Achilles and Troy, intentional?
Oh, of course.
Tell me what you're thinking there.
Oh, well, for a number of reasons. People often ask about the names as though they're odd, but you know, who names black people, right? Tyrone Geronimo Johnson. That's my name. Tyrone is Irish, comes from like Tyr Owen. Geronimo comes from a name that now they realize they may have misheard than Johnson. There was no one in my family named John who had a son. There's no accounting for my name at all. And so that's part of the question it raises. You know, what does it mean to name? What place does your name have? And it just...
Like, are you trying to make some reference to Greek tragedy here?
Well, that as well. Of course, definitely that as well. But the book is not at all a retelling of the Iliad. So Marilynne Robinson once said that a character should do nothing. They should never act for anything less than seven reasons. And I feel like as a writer, like all of these major decisions should be considered in light of that. So there are several reasons that they have those names. One is to raise the question of names, and one is, of course, to evoke the pressure of these myths, but it's not because the myths are working in favor of the book. It's almost because the myths are working against the book in a way.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Geronimo, for coming to WMUK.
Thank you.